Welcome to Theology on Tuesday, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. Come grab a seat if you can. We've got a little bit of space left on the steps. We always have room. Sometimes we don't always have room on the floor, but there is some right now if we're really pressed for space. But we're glad that you are here. My name is Justin, and this is Brian, and you're at Theology on Tuesday. If this is your first time, the way the evening goes is we talk about any given topic, it seems like. Tonight we're finishing up a great book that we have been talking about for the last four, or this is our fourth session on it. But after about 25, 30 minutes talking about the topic for tonight, you can, well really at any point, you can scan this top QR code. You'll see these little sheets around the room. And you can ask anything you want to us. We've had some fun questions over the years that people have posed to us, and we'll do our best to be succinct and try to answer your question. You'll also see everybody else's questions, so you can like the ones that you like and want asked. And I think Matthew is going to be our moderator tonight, so he's going to do the best that he can to get as many questions posed to us as possible. A couple of housekeeping items. You can join our email list down by that bottom left QR code. That's the main way that we communicate. We also have just our personal Instagram and Facebook, that sort of thing, where we share when we're meeting. But we meet every other Tuesday for the most part. There are a few things that are coming up. If you are, so it's the season of Lent. Ash Wednesday started last week. We talked, I think, about that. Mm-hmm. But there are some opportunities that you can really, if you're looking to kind of take the season of Lent seriously, maybe take up a new habit, whether it's service or a Bible study, there's two options here I want to draw your attention to. There is a Bible study for the guys, if you're in your 20s or 30s. Colton, who was instrumental in getting Theology on Tuesday started a few years ago, he is leading a Bible study for the guys, and you can see some information there. Just text him if you're interested and you want to go. And there's also what's called the Walk for Water, which is a great thing, water mission, where they use helping the world really get clean water, and they share the gospel through that. And there's a wonderful way to help support their ministry by doing what's called the Walk for Water. It's on the 29th. It's a Saturday morning, and you get to walk around carrying buckets of water to remind yourself that people around the world have to walk a long ways to get water. And so it's a great service opportunity, raises awareness. We'll be there, and we'd love for you to join us. And also, there's this other group called Holy City Life. Was birthed out of this time together where people were like, we'd like to have some more time than just every other Tuesday. And so they have a bunch of social opportunities there. And I see Alexandra there. I haven't seen, is Meredith here? I don't know if she is. But Alexandra, can you raise your hand? She's on the steps. She heads that up, and you can talk to her about what's coming up. Or you can join the group me by scanning that bottom QR code. I think that's all the housekeeping.
Nope. There's one more. So one of the things that is happening this weekend is our diocese is having its annual convention, and you may think,
what is that?
What is that? You don't really need to even care about that part. But what is the cool thing is that at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, we are having a worship service to start that off, which is open to anyone. And if you are a junkie for like really amazing worship experiences with all kinds of instruments and choirs and 900 people singing and all of that, it's going to be an incredible worship service at 4 o'clock at St. Philip's. So if you are inclined that way, come check it out. It'll be a great time.
I will say, it's very rare to get an experience of singing alongside of 900 people where the intention is actually hearing the congregational's voices.
Yeah.
So you can go to a concert and hear somebody perform, but when you're in a space, just that alone is a really amazing experience. So you should come. Glad you brought that up. What are we doing tonight? So we've been talking about the defining decade, why your 20s matter, and how to make the most out of them. It's been a great few weeks where we've gone through this book by Meg Jay. We've talked about work. We've talked about relationships. We've talked last time about the brain and how important your 20s are. One of the premises behind this book is that, you know, a lot of folks think, well, 30 is the new 20. My 20s don't really matter. I can kind of just go have a good time. And what's the big deal? And all throughout this book, she's arguing, actually, your 20s are perhaps the most consequential years of your life. And this week, we are talking about your body in particular, that your 20s are really prime when it comes to the things going on in your body. Where do you want to start with this issue?
Well, I think part of where we can start is that our culture has such a messed up view of bodies and embodiment and all of that, and we have moved, particularly if you're somebody as old as I am, I've been able to watch this over my lifetime, this whole idea of virtual relationships is something that was like completely unknown for most of my life. And so part of what she's talking about here is that our bodies matter and that they are sacred and that they are imbued with purpose and they are designed in a particular way to facilitate various things like childbearing and work and all of those sorts of things. But that our bodies, contrary to what our culture says, our bodies wear out. And y'all are too young to really experience that. I am, as Justin knows, dealing with a sprained knee and a torn meniscus right now, which is a sign that my body is wearing out. But part of what she's talking about here is that there are things like parenthood and certain types of work and certain approaches to life that are really important to engage with while you are young and not postpone those.
Yeah, I think that one of the things she said earlier in the book was that you'll look at teenagers, they try to act and be 20, and everybody past their 20s tries to look 20 and be 20 as well. And so on the one hand, 20s are the disposable years, they think, but then on the other hand, everybody wants to be in their 20s and how they act and how they look in our culture. It's this real, really kind of ironic thing. One of the things that I think from a Christian perspective, just to build off of what you said, is that the aging process, growing unto maturity, is actually a really good thing.
Yes.
Proverbs talks about this too, like the crown of an old man is his gray hair or something like that. I could have totally butchered that. And we should say those without hair because they've grown too. Like, I think that's a sign of maturity. But it does not despise the physical aging. And in fact, it is saying, no, this is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And that's true of, you know, your bodies as they age in a sense. But experiencing the different seasons of life is a good thing. Obviously, death was a result of the fall and sin entering the world. But the different seasons of life are important and not to be despised.
Yes.
And I think that goes very much against the way, even as she talked about, the culture which wants to keep and remain in your 20s all the time. Mm-hmm. Which is really kind of sad, actually.
Yeah.
And you know those people who are like, you clearly are not in your 20s, but you've spent a ton of money. I mean, she talks a little bit, I don't know, does she talk a little bit about the, like, cosmetic surgery and that sort of thing? Maybe she doesn't, but I couldn't remember if it was in this chapter or previous chapters.
I think it is, yeah.
But spending a lot of time and money in something that's really not only
stop time
fleeting, but also despising the good progress that God wants us to have.
Yeah, and one of the other things that she talks about in here, which I think is really important, is that it's so easy to just keep postponing and thinking, I'll think about these big questions and these big issues in my life later. I'm just not going to deal with it right now. But the part of what happens, she says, is you end up at some point, if you've done that for too long, you end up in your late 30s or early 40s, and you're in this crunch period because you have these like life goals that you wanted to have kind of in the back of your mind, but you didn't do anything toward trying to achieve them. And so all of a sudden, in your late 30s, early 40s, you're trying to cram all of this in there while you are still biologically able to have children, while you're still able to do all of these various things. And so part of what she says is it's really important when you're in your 20s to think about, what do I want my life to look like when I'm in my 50s, 60s, 70s? What are the building blocks that I want to have in place? And then work your way backward on the timeline to figure out how you're going to make that happen. Because if you don't do that, then what ends up happening is you find that you've got this closing window that you're trying to cram all this stuff into.
Yeah. So in this chapter, she talks in particular about fertility. And that may be something, talking to a bunch of 20-somethings, like, why are we even talking about this? But she says it's actually incredibly important. And some of the things she says in here were so sad to read about people as they really, because guess what? Your body doesn't care what you think you want out of your life. It does have a clock, so to speak. And so one of the things that struck me about what she said was dealing with folks who were in their 30s and recognizing, you know, well, you and I both talked about this before, like trying to, especially in a very achieving society where you want to get in the best schools and get the best job and make the most money, and usually both partners, a husband and wife, are striving to that. That's more often the case than not now, it seems like. And the reality is you just think that you could have it all, including the three kids that, or two kids, whatever, and the cars and all that. And you work so hard, you've invested into certain areas of your life, and maybe you're still single, maybe you're not at the point where you've thought about having kids, and all of a sudden, as you said, that window starts to close, and coming, she talks about it's dealing with the grief of not being able to do it. Oh, this is what I was thinking of. When she mentioned, you know, folks in their, it's not uncommon now to see people having children in their 40s. So she spends a lot of time just dealing with basic fertility facts, which was news to me. I didn't know a lot of the things she talks about. Once you hit 30, once you hit 35, once you hit 40, chances of actually having a successful pregnancy. And it basically, like, 30 is a big year. 35 is when it starts to really go down, and 40 is like a free fall, pretty much. Yeah. And she says, well, you can see it on, like, in Hollywood. You know, she's a psychologist, a sociologist, and oftentimes she'll hear from folks, well, I see, you know, so-and-so in Hollywood or on TV who's gone through fertility treatments and they end up having a child at 42 or 43 or something like that. And she said, actually, what you probably didn't see is it's 30 grand a pop to do some of these things. And it maybe took 5, 6, 7 times to do it. And that's just a very small number that actually can do it. And so I forget what she called it, but it's one of those things, just because I've seen an example of it, therefore it's likely to happen.
Right.
But those are things that I think are really important. She speaks very honestly. And I think that's one of the reasons we wanted to come back and talk about this, which these things are worth talking about.
Yeah, and one of the things she talks about, part of what makes this book so good, now I do want to just encourage y'all again to buy the book or listen to it on Audible or whatever. Part of what makes the book so good and so poignant in so many places is she has all of these actual anecdotes from the people that she has been working with. And part of what is so sad is that when you hear these stories of regret from people who focused on other things, and then all of a sudden when they're much later in life, they realize, oh, wait, all the things that I wanted, I'm not sure that they are biologically possible now.
Right.
And it's just, it's very sad to see that. And, you know, I think on the one hand, you don't want to try to put guilt on people about that. But the flip side of it is to try to understand that our culture, so much of the messaging in our culture about all this is wrong. And so often when Justin and I both do a lot of weddings, and so often when I'm doing marriage prep, I will hear from people, yeah, we have wanted to wait to get married until we both had our dream job and we were able to buy a $1 million house. Well, maybe. But the problem with that is that you've postponed everything. And part of what used to happen is people would get married earlier and they would build their life together. And now more and more what you see is people building their individual lives till they get to this career goal. And then at that point, they start thinking about, who am I going to share my life with? And I would like to suggest that that is exactly backwards.
Well, yeah, tease some of that out. Why is that really... I think it's important to make the connections that that's actually, and that's really what she's doing in here, is that selling you a bill of goods that actually is going to be deeply problematic if you want certain things. And she talks about, like, most people still want to have children. They want to be married, even non-Christians, all that stuff. So why is that so backwards?
Yeah, well, I think part of the reason it's so backwards, one is that you've got the fertility issues from being older, but the other thing, too, is that if you are at the pinnacle of your career and you have little children and both people are trying to have their pinnacle career thing going on and having little children, that doesn't work. And unless you are viewing your children as being like an accessory for your Instagram influencer posts, and you're just gonna farm them out to other people to bring up, if you wanna actually have a family where you're deeply committed to one another, it's very difficult to imagine that along with two high profile career kinds of things. And she also talks a lot about how the older you get, the more you may run into physical issues, you may run into health issues, you may run into energy issues, and that you get into the situation where you're trying to raise toddlers, but you're at the same time dealing with your aging parents, and you know, you just get stuck in this vise because of that.
And that was one of the alarming things, is to think about, you know, at the rate that people are having children. So first of all, the birth rates are going lower because the biological clock has ticked so much that many people aren't able to have the children they want. And so you've got this large gap between the grandparents and then the children, so much so that we're not that far away from a society where it is normal to have grandparents who are on death's door, and they never actually have a meaningful relationship with grandchildren. I mean, that's some of the reality of what she's talking about. That's worth naming. And what I appreciate, what she's doing, again, not trying to guilt or shame people, but help. I mean, she says most of what she does is just sit with people and like kind of map out a timeline mm-hmm. of like what you're doing and helping you connect the dots to, okay, so if you want to have a couple years of being married before you have a child, that's a good thing. But then you probably need to be married at this time. And if you want to be married at this time, you probably need to start seriously looking for a partner around this time, which really goes against the I just have all the time in the world kind of thing mentality.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that she talks about is that, you know, I think that there, and I'm not going to ask people to raise their hands, but I think that there are probably a lot of people in this room who think, well, I would love to be married, but there's like not the person in my life right now. And she would definitely affirm that, but she would also say that it's important to try to figure out if your goal is to be married, to be figuring out some ways to work toward that. And you might remember back early on when we were talking about work, she talked about the power of weak connections or something like that. But basically the idea of using your network to meet people. And I think that is something that's really important, because part of the, again, the bill of goods that we've been sold by our culture, whether it's Hallmark movies or whatever it might be, that suddenly this person that's the perfect person for you is just going to walk into your life and sweep you off your feet. And that is not, I'm sorry if I'm bursting anyone's bubble, that is highly unlikely. And it's much more likely that you will marry someone that you know, that you meet through friends, that you've come to know, that you might not immediately have thought, oh, this is the person. It's like my wife, who is awesome, who I'm very grateful that God brought her into my life. We were friends and both dating other people for like the first 2 years that we knew each other. But over time, we became more and more drawn to each other. And that is much more the way things are likely to happen than to have, you know, Mr. Wonderful or Miss Wonderful sort of ride in on a cloud into your life.
Yeah, in a very short period of time,
right?
Just magically there. You know, one of the things, and maybe I just completely missed this in the education growing up as a child, but one of the stats, and I think it's worth even just saying this, but without assisted reproductive technologies, it takes 25% chance of conception, pretty much, between a healthy husband and a wife. That's just normal. I think so. It takes usually about 4 months to, if everything, and that's at age 30. So she talks about by age 40, it is 20 months, 5% of the time as opposed to 25% of the time likelihood of conceiving and caring to full term, which is pretty crazy because if you think about at 40 trying to do 20 months of getting pregnant, you start to do the math and you're going, oh. And then we haven't even begun to talk about again, this is not from a Christian perspective, a lot of good stuff in here, but from a Christian perspective, talking about what does it mean to be a mom and a dad? What are the ethical implications of some of the assisted reproductive technologies that are available? One of the many things that we're all grappling with, I mean, a cell phone, right? Like just because we have the ability to have technology, look at the dangerous side effects that we've seen with just the cell phone. So I think hopefully we'll get to maybe that later on. But you know, one of the things that I wanted to mention that I hear a lot with, and again, like I want to encourage folks to not feel ashamed if they're not married or not looking towards it. But if that's something that you want to do, and the Bible does talk about keep being married, having children is a good thing, that these are things that are really tied to a meaningful life. And Jesus yet was single, so there's goodness in singleness. But by and large, most people are looking to get married, and that's a good thing. And children are a good thing. But there's this lie out there, and I even looked it up. I typed into Google, how much does it cost to have a child in 2023? Anyone want to take a guess? Have you seen these before? How much does it cost to have a child? Anybody want to take a stab at it?
$1 million.
And so like over 18 years, what are you paying? Not quite a million.
$200,000.
Higher than that. $375,000.
And so if I'd never have children, I'd be a multimillionaire.
You could have it all, Brian. Delivery, and that includes, so the cost of delivery without insurance, baby gear in a nursery, clothes, regular like cleaning supplies with children, daycare, preschool, primary school, college, maybe not college actually, because it's 18, and then food, clothing, housing, and healthcare. And I looked at what they were kind of quoting, and let me just say, we have three children of my own. That is so inflated.
Yeah, it's nowhere close.
And it's all in this, well, you have to have X number of cars, and you have to have X number of square feet in your home. And you, like, our three kids all were in the same bedroom, and, you know, they seem to be doing all right. And when you think about, like, having food, too,
they're all
right?
going to be in therapy, Justin.
Yeah, they're like, that. Dad did this book one time, Theology on Time. No, but you think about like the inflated food costs of even what they're quoting, it's really not that at all. It doesn't take rocket science for you to realize like just even making food, it means eating leftovers basically. It means being wise about what you spend your money on. Your lifestyle will be affected. But guess what? Some things are worth sacrificing for to have the more meaningful things like relationships with a spouse or children.
Yeah.
And I think that's just not talked about. And everybody, like even friends my age, they're like, oh, I just don't have enough money to do this. And there's some wisdom in that, but it is not the $375,000 range.
Way off in terms of degree.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one of the things that is so prevalent in this part of the book, in the anecdotes, is why did no one ever talk to me about this? Why did no one ever talk to me about this? Which is part of the reason that we're talking about it, even though it's sort of uncomfortable. But the other thing that she talks about in here was that whole idea of grandparents at death's door. And since I'm the only grandparent in here, I can talk a little bit about this. Fortunately, I'm not at death's door. One of the things that was really beautiful with our children is we encouraged them that if they found the right person to get married early and not wait until they finished everything and achieved all these goals. And so that has happened. And so really remarkably, when our first grandchild was born, he had all his grandparents and plus eight great-grandparents all still living, which was an amazing thing. But the great thing for me is I can have a relationship with these grandchildren, and hopefully I'm going to be around for a while, so I'll have a long relationship with them. Whereas if I were 85, you know, not so much. So
yeah. Did you want to, the closing one about Billy in that vignette, do you want to try to do that, or is that too long? It's so good, though.
It's so good.
223 through 24.
All right, I'm going to read this. I'm going to read it fast. All right, so this is about a guy named Billy who was got married in his mid-30s, had a son, had a big job, lots and lots and lots of stress, He started having chest pains, went to the hospital for an MRI. And so he went to the MRI, and this is his story. So I went for my MRI, excuse my language, and it was really a fucking scary thing. Being cooped up in that magnet coffin with all the whirring and banging, there was an alarm sound that kept going off. The machine was the only thing in that big sterile room, and the operator sat in a booth on the other side. It was 7:30 in the morning and so cold. They gave me headphones with music to drown out some of the noise, and it was on a preset station. Ozzy Osbourne was playing, believe it or not. There was a time when that would have been funny to me, but it was just ironic or pathetic. Nothing could have felt more irrelevant to my life at that moment than Ozzy Osbourne. I was really scared of what they were going to find. And the funny, no, the really sad thing was my life didn't flash before my eyes, not at all. I'm 38, and there were like two things I had in mind. The way my little son's hand feels when I hold it, and how I didn't want to leave my wife behind to do it all on her own. What seemed plain to me was that I wasn't scared of losing my past. I was scared of losing my future. I felt like almost nothing in my life mattered up until a few years ago. I realized that all the good stuff is still to come. I was so sick and panicked that I might never see my son ride a bike, play soccer, graduate from school, get married, have his own kids, and my career was just getting started. Nothing is wrong, thank God, but this has made me face some things. I saw my regular doctor a couple of days after the MRI, and I told her she needed to keep me going a good 20 years at least. She said she sees that a lot now. When people had kids at 22, it was pretty much a given you'd be around to finish what you started. No one worried about it. Now she says a lot of parents come in and say, hey, I need to be healthy at least till my kids are in college. Please be sure I make it that long. How screwed up is that? What I can't figure out and what I feel like I'm grieving a little is why I spent so many years on nothing. So many years doing things and hanging out with people that don't even rate a memory. For what? I had a good time in my 20s, but did I need to do all that for 8 years? Lying there in the MRI, it was like I traded 5 years of partying or hanging out in coffee shops for 5 more years I could have had with my son if I'd grown up sooner. Why didn't someone drop the manners and tell me I was wasting my life?
That's how she ends. And I'm glad you said that because there's, as you said, those vignettes in that book are so powerful. And that's really the climactic one, in my opinion, is that, you know, many people aren't wasting their lives, but there are many who are just in their 20s thinking none of this matters. And it takes suffering like that, and it takes having a child. And it's what's scary is like, man, I just want to stay alive. You're like, we're not guaranteed tomorrows, but it's not terribly uncommon to die in your 50s, 60s. And you'll still have teenagers at some of this rate. Yeah. So that was a powerful thing, and I'm glad you read it.
And I think part of what she's trying to get at is not to like make everyone be really depressed now, but I think part of what she's trying to get at is it is so important to live your life with intentionality and to begin to set goals, to think about what do I want my life to be, and to discern through prayer and people who love you what I want my life to look like, and then to begin taking action to move in that direction. And there are a couple of books that I want to really strongly recommend. Thank you. So I'm going to turn the wine glass over. One of them, besides The Defining Decade, is The Meaning of Marriage. We've talked about this before. Most people think, well, I shouldn't read that. I'm not getting married. This is such a great book to read when you're not dating anyone, where there's nothing on the horizon, where you're not even sure you want to be married. If you want a Christian understanding of what marriage is all about, this thing is worth its weight in gold. So I would really encourage you to read that.
Either they say it, or Meg Jay says it, the best time to prepare is before you're in a marriage.
Yep. Yeah. And the other thing is, we live in a culture that's very self-absorbed. One of the best things you can do is read some good biographies of people who led amazing lives. And I want to really recommend these two books that are by Eric Metaxas. One is called Seven Men, and one is called Seven Women. And they are about people who just started as ordinary children, but committed their lives to the Lord, and then went on to lead extraordinary lives. And we don't read much biography, we don't read much about the lives of the saints, but these are really good and inspirational. It'll help you think outside the box. And then last but not least, Tim and Kathy Keller, God's Wisdom for Navigating Life, which is based on the book of Proverbs. There's a lot of wisdom in Proverbs. And this is a really short book. It's a year of daily readings. And this is something that would take you 5 minutes a day to do this, but it will bless your socks off if you read it.
That's awesome. How are we doing on questions? I know
we've got three so far.
Okay. So while people take a moment and begin to pose their questions, I'll highlight a few of the books that I brought. I brought this last time, The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting a Generation Up for Failure. Jonathan Haidt is a guy that you might have heard of. Really, really helpful book talking about basically not always just bowing down to your feelings, but you know, that human beings, I quoted from it last time, human beings are by nature anti-fragile, which means they need the challenge, the stressors, the things in order to grow, right? Yeah. And that if you just stay stagnant and avoid stressors, you're actually not going to flourish. I think I brought this last time, Bioethics, A Primer for Christians. If we talk about, there are so many issues, Adam and Eve after the pill. So essentially the sexual revolution and the technological revolution that we have, the pill being one of those, has made so many changes. And both of the books here, Mary Ebersat is fantastic on talking about some of the consequences of that. This is a book that I brought this time, didn't bring it last time, Feminism Against Progress. We did one on the Barbie movie back when it came out. We did a theology
on Tuesdays. Yeah, which is the podcast archive. It was quite fun.
Deep down there. But what I appreciate about this is she was a hardcore, I would say, second wave feminist, and not a Christian. I don't think she still is a Christian, but it was through things like coming to give birth to a real child that completely changed the way she thought about the world. And in fact, in the book that we've been doing with Meg J, she talks about how feminism, actually true feminism, should make you appreciate things like being a mother and that sort of thing, not at the expense of you know, the ability to have careers and all sorts of that stuff.
Yeah.
But it's, anyways, so I brought some of those and would be happy to talk more about.
Yes, and these will be up here if you want to come take pictures of the covers or anything.
All right, so as a segue, thoughts on stay-at-home moms versus working moms?
So I think that it is really important for each couple to evaluate very carefully what God is calling them to, and that I think there's often a presumption that I can't afford or we can't afford to be a stay-at-home mom, and that's just wrong. Sorry.
No, I think... Yeah.
But it's just wrong. It's just wrong. And I remember early when we were married and we had our first child, my wife was making a lot of money, and we were going to have to take a major hit if she stayed home. But we really felt that God was calling us to do that. And so we took the hit, and it was fine. I mean, it was totally fine. There were some things that we had to give up, but it was so worth it. And I think that you can make it work. There are joys that you can experience as a stay-at-home mom that you just don't get otherwise. I think that it is possible to work outside of the home and still have a good family life, but my bias would be if there's any way to be at home. You know, people used to think that the highest calling in the world was to be a stay-at-home mom. People used to think that. And I think about my own mother. My mother is a genius. She did really well in college. She did really well in graduate school, a top school. She could have made a fortune in the working world, but she chose to stay home and, you know, invest in her children. And a lot of her peer group did that, and it's sad that we've lost that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you just to build off of what you said, it's not inherently sinful to have two working parents. But if you probe beneath some two dual-working parents, it may be because you're trying to strive for a certain standard that the real question is, and this is one of you're like, can we afford to have one person not work? The real question, and this is something, I mean, my wife was a school teacher for 10 years and did that as a mom as well. And that was, you know, it was great and challenging all at the same time. But then we started to realize, can we afford not to do that? Because what we saw, and I'll tell a story, I was talking to somebody today and his wife works at a local preschool here and sees this a lot where the child, and it's like 2 or 3 years old, calling the teacher mom, and the nanny comes and picks up, and the nanny is called mom, and the actual biological mom got really upset and was calling and was like, well, you're having your child here 40 hours a week, and then you have a nanny, and like you come in at the very end of the day. And so really, what I, and I see this sometimes, and it's like, you're just trying to build a relationship with your kid, not, and you feel like you're not even succeeding in that, but you have an injunction as a Christian to actually pass on the things that are life-giving and meaningful in the Christian faith. You're supposed to do more than just have a relationship, and yet you don't even have that because you don't have the time to do it.
Right. Yep.
And that's just heartbreaking. And so there's some real cost, and I think that's what I love about this book is consider all the cost. Can you afford relationally and the things that you really value, can you afford to live the way that you're currently living? I think it's an important question. But actually, oh, crud, I forgot what I was going to say about this book, though. It was gone. All right.
Next question.
Yeah.
Right. How do you set a timeline for marriage and kids when you haven't met your spouse yet?
That is such a great and real question. Thank you for asking that, whoever did. I think that you can pray into a timeline and say, God, this is the desire of my heart, and then share with a mentor or some older people in your life about that and think through what might be a strategy or strategies to help move you in that direction. Because I think that for many of us, it's kind of what I was talking about earlier, that there's this disconnect, that that's what we want, but we're also kind of in the headspace of that person is just going to drop down on a cloud from heaven. And that's not the way it works. So you have to be putting yourself into situations where you will meet people. And I don't mean dating apps, although some people think that's a good thing, but putting yourself into places where there are other people, doing things with groups of people, asking your friends, asking adults, you know, and putting yourself into social situations where you will meet people. But I think the main thing is to prayerfully consider what that timeline, what you would desire, and say to the Lord, this is my heart's desire, help show me how to move in that direction, and share that with some older and wiser Christians in your life.
Yeah, I think that was great. That was a really, I don't have anything to add to that, but I did think about what I was going to say to this question. It was the Industrial Revolution, she says in here, really did a number on moms because they had meaningful economic work in the home, and then the Industrial Revolution moved out of the home. And it was like, man, that really did a number on women. That's not right. And so,
well, and that's one of the great stories that's in this book, the biography of Susanna Wesley, who was the mother of John Wesley and Charles Wesley, who were both famous hymn writers, preachers, all of that. And she had, I think, maybe 10 children, maybe even 12. But just incredible woman, definitely not a shrinking wallflower, but stayed at home and did amazing things.
Yeah, and I think going back to the question that was posed is the important thing in a timeline, you can't control the results in many ways. In a relationship, you can't control what somebody else does. You can control what you do, and the whole point is, are you taking meaningful action in that?
So, yeah.
What do we got next?
All right, so what is the biblical view of untraditional routes of having children? In vitro fertilization, surrogacy, and adoption?
Okay, they asked it.
Yes, so that is a very complicated question to answer fully, but to do sort of a quick overview, the Bible loves adoption. Adoption is one of the most biblical things you could ever, ever do. And it is all over scripture, and it is a beautiful metaphor that's used about Christ adopting us. So adoption is a beautiful thing. In vitro fertilization and surrogacy, I think there are both, with both of those, there are some fairly major bioethical and scriptural issues. And there would be complicated to go into all of it, but one of the things with IVF is that very often there are multiple embryos that are created, and only one or two may actually be implanted and then survive, and then all the rest are either frozen or are executed. And if you believe that life begins at conception, that is hugely problematic. Surrogacy, there is a whole nother host of issues connected with that. And I think some surrogacy is worse than other surrogacy, but I would say none of it is ideal.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a personal question because I think we have family, friends, deeply, I know I do, who are affected by these. And so I think, and yet we still are talking about it. It's important because I know so many people who are pro-life, and yet that, like what you mentioned about in vitro fertilization, is not even on their radar, that you're actually in many ways not living into the pro-life potentially. And, you know, the medical field is not neutral. They, in many ways, you need to ask some of the questions as you're doing this of, you know, what happens if you go down this route to those embryos and that sort of thing. You know, the other, there's intrauterine insemination, IUI, instead of IVF. That's where they insert male sperm into a female reproductive. And that's like 15% of the time, even in your 20s, is effective. So it's, a lot of these are actually really ineffective. IVF, really expensive. And you have to start thinking about both with those as well as surrogacy. What is being a mother, like hosting another child, even though the DNA is not your own, it's not nothing to house a child in your womb that in some ways does contribute to being a mom. There's a lot of complex issues. I will say one of the best chapters I read on this is in this book, Bioethics and Primer, and it has a whole chapter devoted to these issues of procreation and reproduction, where it talks about artificial reproductive technologies.
Yeah, there's a woman named Katie Faust who has a lot of good work on this, has some podcasts and whatnot. But it's a complex issue, but it is one that's important for Christians to think about.
What's your favorite, what's your favorite thing about your wife?
Oh my gosh. So many things that are great about my wife, but I would say probably one of my favorite things, I'm gonna have two favorite things. One is her sense of humor. She has a really good, dry sense of humor. But the other thing is that she's just like the calmest person I have ever met. She is absolutely unflappable, which is not the way I am. And so it's really great that we're together because she, you know, whatever happens, she's just very calm, and it's a beautiful thing.
She is, yeah. I would say my wife is strong, and she is courageous, and I would say that part of just her strength and resiliency and what she can do is just so humbling to me because I am not like that. She has a spine that I've never seen anybody else who can stand up and do things that are so hard that I've never seen anybody do. And so I love that about her.
COVID changed us forever. Any advice for singles trying to meet their spouse but struggling with dating in 2025 and fighting the isolation that started in 2020?
That is such a great question, and I think that is very real. And I think part of it is saying, okay, all of this happened and all of this sucks, and I'm not gonna be the victim that the situation has created. I'm going to be proactive about trying to deal with that. And I think there are multiple ways of doing that. I think one of the ways that can be really helpful in dealing with that kind of isolation is to be deeply involved in an intergenerational church. One of the things I love at St. Philip's is we have these things called foyer groups that are people of all ages who are sort of thrown together. And I think that can be really helful because part of if your desire is to build relationship, and particularly if your desire is to build relationship and eventually meet someone that might be your spouse, you have to be proactive about that. And that may be really uncomfortable, especially if you're an introvert. But I think this is where you need to rely on people who are in your life, who love you, who are more extroverted and have a wider network than you do. And ask them to do things like have dinner parties or organize a group of 10 people to go do something where there's no pressure, where you don't feel like you're paired off with somebody. But groups of people doing things together is great. I'll just give a plug for Holy City Life for that. That is a non-pressure, non-paired off way of doing things. Doing service with people is a great way to meet people. If you are fortunate enough to be in a friend's wedding, that is a prime situation to be thinking about, because usually if you're in the wedding of someone that you love, the other people that are in that wedding party are going to be people that you are compatible with. And so leaning into those relationships, all of those things can be good. And obviously undergirding all of that with prayer.
Yeah. I see two extremes of people. On the one hand, they have no problem meeting and being around people. In fact, saying no is probably a good thing. But I envision the person asking this question, saying no to like doing too many things with people because they're postponing making really important, hard decisions about just because they're having so much fun with friends. Like I see a lot of folks kind of in that world, but I think the person perhaps asking the question maybe is like, you know, COVID has changed us, but I think that's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Because frankly, every one of us knows Zoom is terrible and trying to do stuff, now everyone knows that. So to say yes as often as you can, work functions and church functions and in person, you know, take charge in trying to meet in person. And that's risky, that's hard, but part of that, and she talks about this, part of the challenge of doing that and putting yourself out there is it's actually shaping you into the kind of person that you hope that you're going to be one day. And everything that you said too, like you're putting yourself strategically in those places. And then I mentioned this last time, like if you're working really hard and doing these things, at the end of the day, you can rest that you know God has a plan for your life. He's good. And you can sleep well knowing that no matter what condition you're in, he's looking out for you and it will come in his timing.
Yeah. And the other thing I would say, and this is a more what not to do, if you are in the rut of going to Upper King Street and getting wasted with the same six people every weekend, that is not going to get you towards your goals. Mm-hmm. So switching that up could be really important.
Yeah.
When trying to date, how do you deal with the fear of rejection?
That is another really great and very honest question. And I think part of it, again, is deeply rooted in how strong your relationship with God is. Because if you are absolutely convinced that God loves you, that you are God's favorite, that he made you exactly the way you are, and he loves you just the way you are, which is what the scriptures tell us, then if you are praying into relationships and it doesn't work out, then you can actually be thankful that you were rejected or that this relationship didn't go anywhere, because that's clearly not the person that God has for you. That involves a lot of mental work, because what our culture tells us is that you're a loser if you get rejected. But that is a cultural view that is not a scriptural view. So I think reframing your thinking on the front end is the most important way to deal with that.
I'm glad you talked about keeping who Jesus says you are at the center of it is really important. But if you think about it, most of us, if you're trying, you're going to be very rarely do you just magically, you know, meet that one person that you end up getting married to the rest of your life. You're going to experience things not working out. You're going to experience rejection. And actually, that's really important to learn how to do well. Mm-hmm. And that's sometimes, you're going to say really dumb things. Like, the amount of times that I've said really stupid things to people on the way, and they're leaving church, it's like, remember the time it was this couple, we had just done like one of these talks, and I was so like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I said that, because they were brand new, and I was like, oh hey, are y'all married, engaged? They had just started dating like a day before, and they turned like bright purple, and I was like.
I was right up there with patting the woman's stomach. It's like, yeah. When's the baby due? I'm not expecting.
Right. But guess what? I've never said that again, because I learned that was really dumb to say. But you have to learn, and you can't take yourself too seriously.
Yeah,
and you have
that's
to
right.
show forgiveness to yourself. And that actually makes you into the kind of person that can ask better questions and be the kind of person that in many ways makes relationships flourish.
Yes.
So don't be afraid of rejection. Even though it said, what do you do with fear? Acknowledge it, but then put yourself out there still. It's just kind of like what, you know, the Jonathan Haidt book. Like, you need to grow by failing many times.
Peter Pan syndrome. it gets so loud sometimes. Peter Pan syndrome seems common in adults nowadays. As someone with my own foibles on this, how can we fight back against this?
Okay, yeah, so Peter Pan syndrome, I think, so... How many of y'all have actually read Peter Pan or watched the movie? Okay, that's really good. Yay. All right, a culturally literate bunch. So the basic idea of Peter Pan is all summed up in that song that's in the musical version, I'll Never Grow Up. And it's sort of the idea that you just continually are a child or a teenager and you don't ever take responsibility, thank you.
Yeah, that fell down.
I was so excited about that.
You don't take responsibility.
Yes, thank you. But the problem is that there can be a period where Peter Pan is appropriate, like when you're like 12 to 14. But Peter Pan syndrome when you're 30 is not cute anymore. And so I think particularly Peter Pan syndrome is more of an issue for boys than it is for... Did I hear an amen?
I think we did.
And part of that is, I think, conditioned partially by the media, the portrayal of what's normal for guys is that guys are stupid, they are emotionally unintelligent, and all they want to do is sit in the basement and play video games while they drink beer. And I think a lot of guys have sort of absorbed that view of what it means to be a young man, and that is part of the problem. So I think fighting against that is really important. If you are a young man, one of the best ways to fight Peter Pan syndrome is to get a good mentor who is an older man who can help you with that. And I think it can happen with women too, who are sort of stuck in the what I think of as a sorority / bachelorette mode that they're just stuck in, and the restaurants in Charleston seem to be full of them on weekends. But that can also be a thing for women. And again, I think finding an older mentor, doing the things that we've talked about tonight of setting goals and all of that will help move you out of that, because I think part of what drives Peter Pan syndrome is fear. People are afraid of the unknown. They feel like, I was a reasonably successful teenage guy, so if I just kind of keep doing my thing, I'm going to be happy. But the problem is that doesn't work.
Yeah, it's a fear of closing off options.
Yes.
And that's going to cause me to miss out. And,
yeah. And
actually,
she talks about that a lot in the book.
She says, actually, you can't afford to do that because you're... whether you like it or not, the options are closing over time.
Yeah.
But almost saying the opposite of what you said, in addition to what you said, I would agree. But a way to fight Peter Pan syndrome, if you know a family member or a friend who's in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and they're there, they're in the city, I know some of them, who have Peter Pan syndrome, That is a wonderful motivator.
Wake up call.
Because it's really sad.
It is.
It is really sad, and it will motivate you to be like, I don't want to be like that. And, you know, that's one of the things that this delay in marriage is so damaging. It has long-term repercussions, but not the least of which being on men. Because marriage and, again, Mary Harrington and the Feminism Against Progress talks about this. What it does for men to be married and to have children is it makes it, in some ways, domesticates them because they need that. They need the load. Men are like trucks that... If you are driving down the interstate and you're a big 18-wheeler and you have nothing that you're carrying, it can waver. But the more weight, the more responsibility that men have, the straighter they drive, because that's the way they were designed. And I think this prolonging of a lack of responsibility is really damaging to men in particular. So find terrible examples and find good examples. Yep. And learn from both. Well, that is all the time we have. Thank you all so much. This has been so much fun doing this.
Yes.
We'll be back in 2 weeks, and it's time for a fishbowl night, I think.
It is. We've got so many questions.
We've got 6 months. So yep. We'll be around to keep the conversation going.
Yep.
We'll see you next time.
Thanks for coming.